This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last night, President Obama gave his seventh and last State of the Union address to Congress and the American people. As expected, he reported the State of the Union is strong, and he spent much of his speech summing up his 7 years in office. As has been common in the modern era, his talk to the nation was followed by the response from the party not holding the White House, in this case the Republicans, who chose South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for that task. It is said she had free rein to write her own speech. Having been thrust into the national spotlight in the aftermath of the Charleston church shootings and the lowering of the Confederate flag from the statehouse grounds in Columbia, perhaps the GOP was looking to see how the public might react to her in more normal circumstances, a sort of trial balloon to see if she might be a good choice for vice president. Or maybe they chose her because South Carolina is an important primary state in the upcoming election. We'll talk about both those theories and about what these two speeches may mean to the presidential campaigns of candidates on both sides of the aisle, and we start that analysis in South Carolina with the help of Drs. Scott Huffman and Adolphus Belk. Dr. Huffman is professor of political science and founder and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop University, where he also directs the Winthrop Poll. And Dr. Belk is professor of political science and director of the African American Studies Program at Winthrop University. He also collaborates on the Winthrop Poll. Welcome to both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you back. Why do you think Governor Haley was chosen for this? I guess it would be an honor, I would think, to be chosen to make this address. Why do you think she was chosen?
Well, you know, she has been sort of pushed as the potential new face of the Republican Party, and she's been very popular in sort of the internal intra-party circles, both with her activity for the Republican Governors Association, as well as headlining fundraisers around the country, but those are only the sort of political insiders that knew her. This was really stepping up to prime time. You know, she's articulate. She can give a good speech. She usually can emote well with the crowd, although, you know, she did very well last night, but she didn't do as well as she usually does with speaking. And that's because it's really tough when you're just talking to a camera and you don't have an audience to
play off of. I thought she was great.
But you see her in person and she can connect even better with an audience. Okay. But, you know, she's the first female governor of South Carolina, first minority governor of South Carolina.
And the youngest governor.
And so she really represents a new face. This was a chance to put her out and see if she connected with rank-and-file Republicans. Mm-hmm. It carried a lot of danger as well. I mean, you remember, you know, Marco Rubio fumbling with his sip
water.
Of water.
Yeah.
And
Bobby Jindal kind of flaming out.
Yeah, his rising star just flamed out right there. So there was some danger with it, but she performed well. And, you know, everybody says, is it an audition for the vice presidency? Well, whether it is or isn't, if she'd have done very poorly, I think her vice presidential hopes would have been dashed.
You know, it struck me as interesting, her choice, because she was swept into office because of the Tea Party in South Carolina. And the Republicans are having a problem with that wing of their party. They are recognizing that problem starkly in this presidential campaign. They've had a problem with them hijacking the Congress and causing John Boehner to be driven out of office as the Speaker of the House. Is giving her this job, was it a smart thing, Professor Bell, for them to do that?
I think part of what's happening here is that it's a recognition that she's done some good service for the party. If you go back to the Charleston massacre and the talk that had taken place about the Confederate flag prior to that happening, you know, it was something that people didn't want to touch, but it was definitely going to be a topic of conversation during the primary season and going into the primary election itself. She took that off the table for them, and in doing so, removed a major topic of conversation that they did not want to address. Then, when we look at her emergence, right, when she was running for governor, she was probably fourth or fifth in a very crowded field. And while she had the backing of someone like Mitt Romney, it was really the Sarah Palin endorsement that vaulted her to the front of the field. Mm. Now, years later, she's sort of distancing herself from the more radical elements of the Tea Party that are not interested in governing, and she's more cozying up to the country club Republicans.
Well, let's talk about that, because when I watched her speech last night, I thought, man, she was swept into office on the Tea Party. Is she disappointing? Because she sounded very mild, and she echoed the president in some sections of that speech, what he had just said.
Right. Like, if you look at the talk, she really sort of went strongly at those people within the Tea Party that are not interested in governing. They're much more committed to the ideology and want true believers who are willing to shut down the government rather than compromise on certain issues. And really, while the middle is muddy in the general population, you need people in the middle in government because that's where you get things done. And so she pushed back against those folks, but then she also called out the president for being an empty suit, that he can give great speeches, he can take us to the heights with words, but he can't deliver on the things that he's promised.
And that is how she began her speech last night.
Unfortunately, the president's record has often fallen far short of his soaring words. As he enters his final year in office, many Americans are still feeling the squeeze of an economy too weak to raise income levels. We're feeling a crushing national debt, a health care plan that has made insurance less affordable and doctors less available, and chaotic unrest in many of our cities. Even worse, we are facing the most dangerous terrorist threat our nation has seen since September 11th. And this president appears unwilling or unable to deal with it. Soon the Obama presidency will end, and America will have the chance to turn in a new direction. That direction is what I want to talk about tonight.
Of course, most every Republican would probably agree with what she just said, but for independents who may have watched the president's speech, or for partisans who may have become even disenchanted with the president over time, did the president effectively counter those comments?
Well, you know, the president's speech was very short on policy, and most State of the Union speeches are a laundry list of things that the president wants to see. And of
even,
course,
even in the final year of
the final year is just with this president and this Congress was just it was a foregone conclusion. Nothing's going to get done. There were only three policies that I counted where he wanted action from Congress. And so Nikki Haley's response to say, you know, listen, he hasn't done a good job really falls into the narrative that rank and file Republicans are believing and seeing. You know, the fact is the economy has been recovering. And, you know, South Carolina's economy recovered a little slower than a national economy, but Nikki Haley has benefited from the sense among people in South Carolina that the South Carolina economy has improved even more than the national economy, even though that's in a literal sense not true. So bashing Obama falls in with the narrative. Most people feel that the country is on the wrong track. Most people in South Carolina feel the country is on the wrong track, even though they think the state's headed in the right direction. And so for the people who are listening for what the Republican response, that I mean, that's simply what was absolutely going to be said by whoever said it. The only question was, would they do a good job or not?
I want to come back to the wrong track later on in this conversation. And she called this not a Republican response, but simply an address to the nation, which is interesting.
That doesn't change the fact that it was the Republican response.
Exactly. She went on to say that if we, the Republicans, held the White House, taxes would be lower for working families and we'd put the brakes on runaway spending and debt. Is that really true? Because isn't the largest part of our spending at the federal level simply interest on the debt followed closely by Medicaid and Medicare?
It's interesting that when you get into these sort of conversations, right, you survey people and they say that government spending is out of control, you need to do things to reduce the deficit and to take down the debt. But then you ask them, well, what are you willing to cut? Are you willing to cut Social Security to
no.
do that? Are you willing to cut Medicare?
No.
Are you willing to cut national defense?
No.
Education?
No.
The only thing they're willing to cut is foreign aid, and foreign aid comprises
nothing.
Less than 1% of the federal budget. And so there's a lot of talk about doing this, but when it comes down to making the hard choices to doing it, people are not willing to follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we talk about Republicans being committed to reducing government and Democrats enlarging government, government grew under George W. Bush. He created a new federal level bureaucratic agency and the Department of Homeland Security. It started out as an office, grew to a department, and that was a great expansion of government.
But that's why Tea Partiers are mad. That's why the truly conservative wing of the Republican Party is mad.
The Freedom Caucus especially, which are a lot of the Tea Parties too. But she also went out of her way to tweak the GOP as well. I mean, you know, the proposals she put forth were, you know, everybody's for a strong country, everybody's for a strong economy. There's, you know, if you didn't know who was saying that, it would be hard to guess which party it was. You know, as Dr. Belk was pointing out, the deficit is actually plummeting. It's at its lowest level in geez, since Bush, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the deficit or the debt is, of course, a very different thing. But, you know, the her stepping out and tweaking the GOP, saying we bear some of the burden for this lack of governance. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Republicans across the country are going to be a little split on that. You know, a lot of folks expect from the Republican response, which, and maybe this is why she called it an address, to simply be a party rah-rah. And she actually said, we Republicans need to take some of the responsibility for this lack of governance. And it wasn't as the usual cheerleading speech. And she hit other things, talking about allowing immigrants in, which, you know, that's going to anger some hardline Republicans. But the truth is, she has led the charge in South Carolina to keep Syrian immigrants out. So she's sort of talking on both sides of this issue, but the country as a whole is only going to hear what she said last
night. Let's hear a piece of that where she took on immigrants and what other candidates in the Republican Party have been saying about immigrants in her speech.
Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation. No one who is willing to work hard, abide by our laws, and love our traditions should ever feel unwelcome in this country.
So she and the president talked about this a lot last night, and she seemed to be talking directly, and so did he, to Donald Trump. Now, if she's going to be a viable GOP vice presidential candidate.
Well, not there won't be a Trump-Haley ticket.
There won't be a Trump-Nikki Haley ticket. What about a Cruz-Haley ticket? Because he talks a lot about this as well.
Well, when you look at some of the talk on immigration from within a Republican Party, this is one of those issues where we see deep differences of opinion within the party, and it's unusual because we're used to seeing them move in lockstep. You have a wing within the party that was sort of represented by George W. Bush that was more moderate on the issue, wanted to have some type of guest worker program, have some type of amnesty, really bringing together elements of policies that were enacted by previous presidents over a number of years. But then the hardliners would like to round up, process, and deport every undocumented immigrant in the United States. And that is just impractical. It would cost anywhere from $12,000 to $13,000 to do that for each individual person. Multiply that by 12 million people. And then they have this fantasy that these undocumented immigrants are crawling under a border, through a border, or some way. And most of the people are people who have overstayed their visas. So she's trying to chart a different course. Like, listen, there are people who are coming to this country that are fleeing some of the things that we're fighting against and that they're willing to do the hard work. But at the same time, she's talking about, well, they need to get in line and go through the proper process like everyone else, when that proper process is riddled with flaws all throughout and has been in need of reform for quite some time.
And she also took on a topic that the Republicans have taken on 62 times by the last count within the Congress, which maybe should light a fire under Democrats. And we're talking about, of course, the health care program.
We would end a disastrous health care program and replace it with reforms that lowered costs and actually let you keep your doctor. We would respect differences in modern families, but we would also insist on respect for religious liberty as a cornerstone of our democracy.
Now, this business of trying to repeal Obamacare, we are now beginning to see hints of an alternative. We've never heard any alternatives from the Republicans about what they would do. They just want to get rid of it.
Right. Well,
we'll fix it.
We have heard repeatedly that there was an alternative. We just never saw it because the quote was always repeal and replace, repeal and replace. And so the answer was, well, replace with what? Well, let's repeal it first, and then we'll tell you. So that has been sort of a talking point for a long time, but we'll see if she's got something coming.
We will wrap up our discussion of the Republican response and move on to the actual State of the Union speech when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Potted Sherlock, all 60 Sherlock Holmes stories retold in 80 minutes in a family-appropriate presentation, January 22nd through 24th at McGlowan Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. You know, Charlotte Talks and NPR are working together at the end of the month. We're exploring what voters across the country think about the 2016 election. And as a part of that, we're going to host a voter roundtable. We want you to be part of it. If you're interested in participating along with other Charlotte area listeners, all you have to do is email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and just like the lottery, we'll be in touch. if you win. And we hope to hear from you soon. Tomorrow on this program at 9 o'clock, despite Charlotte City Council decision in favor of the I-77 toll road, opponents of the project are still working to end it, and we hear from some of them tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, political reporters weigh in on President Obama's last State of the Union speech and his final year agenda, including efforts to reform gun laws and address voter fears over terrorism and the economy.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Winthrop University's Dr. Scott Huffman and Dr. Adolphus Belk about the Republican response to the State of the Union. And we're going to bring in Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte now to talk about the State of the Union address and more. Mike, I want to get your thoughts on Nikki Haley as well. Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson was supposed to be with us this morning, but she has a family emergency that she had to deal with and could not join us. Overall, how did Nikki Haley do from a North Carolinian's point of view, Dr. Heberlig?
Well, I thought it was an interesting speech in the way it combined with President Obama's speech, in that you got the typical things we'd expect in a Republican response, criticizing the president, saying he's all rhetoric and no action, laying out in bullet point form, you know, what Republicans' governance would mean if they were elected. But the middle part of the speech, I thought she effectively used her personal story as growing up as an immigrant, the story of the Charleston massacre, to draw clear contrasts with Donald Trump, as we mentioned earlier. And that sort of made the theme for the evening, both the president and the Republican governor of South Carolina ganging up on Trump. So since Star Wars is back in the theaters, I thought of a metaphor. Going back to the original Star Wars era, that what we've been through the last several months is the cantina scene. And last night, it was the establishment striking back.
She was given, she said, free rein to say whatever she wanted to say, to craft her own speech. Given the stakes of this election year, as perceived by both parties, could that be true? Did nobody from the National Party come to her and say, okay, you got to get these points in. You got to say this about that.
I strongly suspect they said, here's some interesting things that we want to get across. Why don't you write it in your words? And again, I think the her points about immigrants is telling, because she has taken such a hard line in South Carolina against especially Syrian immigrants. And, you know, and she's playing to a certain base in South Carolina. There's a large movement to keep all, you know, Middle Eastern, certainly all Syrian immigrants out. And she's taken a hard line on that, even though governors can't stop the resettlement. So, you know, I'm sure she was given a few talking points that they hoped she would hit. Eric's right, though. Using her personal story, I think, is good. And as people look at her, she does have credibility on this issue about immigration to sort of thread the needle on it. Because, you know, remember when she was running, and she was one of four people running, and she was the one who had absolutely no chance until, as Dr. Belk pointed out, Sarah Palin stepped in. There were three white male establishment candidates. One of them was going to be the next governor, and she ended up winning that primary and going on to win the governorship. Well, during that, a state senator is no longer in, who lost, a very powerful Republican state senator, referred to her as a raghead because her parents are Sikh. And when she grew up Sikh, although she's a Methodist now. And so she has been on the receiving end of these racially tinged taunts about immigration. And so that will give her a bit of a platform.
She is an immigrant. She is a woman.
Her parents are immigrants.
Her parents are immigrants. She's a woman. She's a woman of color, if you want to split hairs, I suppose, and Republicans are eager to put those people at the forefront of their party to show that they are inclusive as well, not just the Democrats. Are they likely to nominate her, more likely to nominate her for vice president, if in fact they do at all, if Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, would they do it if Bernie Sanders was the nominee?
Well, a couple of quick points. First, I think they were smart to sort of give her the ability to develop her own talk, given how spectacularly some of the people who preceded her have failed. Those speeches fell flat. They were terrible, and they did good to get out of her way and let her do her thing. The second point, there's a lot of talk about minority outreach and reaching out to women, and it's also fallen flat. I think back to the 2012 presidential convention. It was one Horatio Alger story after another about pulling themselves up by the bootstraps. But then Condoleezza Rice leveled with people and said, we can't talk about equality of opportunity if we know, given a child's zip code, whether or not that child has access to a quality public school. So there's an effort to put people up front, but representation ought not to be sort of related to representation and influence. You can put people up front, but that's not necessarily going to change the policies. And then finally, there's been a lot of talk about Governor Haley and the vice presidential piece, but I also find it interesting that when all of those other Republicans were brought out to give the response, they were being talked about as presidential material. Not vice presidential material, but presidential material, you know, and the conversation with her, I think, is about the vice president because that's in the moment. But given how ambitious she is, I don't know if that's something she'd be satisfied with.
Well, if Hillary wins, then in 2020, I really think you'll see Nikki Haley entering the fray.
She's young enough to wait them out. The challenge becomes, what do you do in that interim period to keep your name in the national spotlight and to build on your accomplishments as an executive? Because we know, looking at American presidents since the mid-20th century, that most of them have been chief executives at the state level, with voters looking at that as being indicative of some sort of ability to govern a nation.
How many more years does she have left, or more opportunities to be governor does she have left?
18. No, she can't run again. She's out in 18.
Let me take a page, just a moment, from the Donald Trump playbook and ask this question. Given her lineage, can she be the vice president?
Yes.
But was she born in this country?
Oh, of course,
okay,
yes.
Just want to know. I mean, and her parents were citizens at the time she was born.
Yeah, that would matter, but yeah.
It would not matter.
That would not matter. In fact, there's, you know, the Lawrence Tribe thing aside, there has been analysis of what our founders intended
right.
with the term natural-born citizen. And going back to English common law, if your parents were citizens of a country and you weren't there, English common law had you being a citizen of England, and that's what we've drawn on. With one or two exceptions that were then overturned.
Right. So why are we still talking about this when it's fairly clear?
Because Trump can get away with slinging that mud.
Even John McCain has said he thinks all is well, but it ought to be looked into.
John McCain, who was born in Panama.
Yes, exactly.
But both of his parents, the one thing that someone is automatically and this is not debatable, is a natural-born citizen if both the parents are in foreign countries and they work for the U.S. government, which his parents did.
Okay. Let's talk about the president's remarks. Was this a State of the Union, Dr. Heberle, or was this simply a summation of presidential accomplishments?
It was actually less of a summation of presidential accomplishments than I think that the typical State of the Union. The typical State of the Union gives us the president tooting his or her own accomplishments. It lays out, usually in mind-numbing detail, appeals to various party constituencies and various bureaucratic agencies across D.C. and bureaucratic interest groups that they can all say they got their one line in the State of the Union, and lays out appeals to broader American principles and values. What this one did was heavy on the American values at the beginning and the end, and tried to tie that to the president's identification of big problems that are coming down the pike, and he was light on the detailed policy recommendations come in State of the Union.
And it was kind of almost like putting a ribbon on the package, because he started in 2007 and 8 running for office by talking about hope and change. And in this speech, he's still talking about hope for a brighter tomorrow, a better America. It's almost like Ronald Reagan's It's Morning in America again. He was the antithesis of the Republican view of what's going on.
Right, but that was Reagan's 84 re-election, but not sort of the end of his career. And you think back to Bush's final State of the Union speech, and it was exactly like, you know, Eric said, it was sort of a victory lap. Here's all the things we've done. Everything's going great in Iraq. The Iraqis are picking up. And, you know, and if you go back and listen to Bush's or read Bush's final State of the Union address and then imagine Iraq now, it's, you know, obviously it wasn't true. But one of the things I think that a lot of it was, again, drawn on what Eric said, was, you know, things are okay. And it was a response obliquely to the whole Make America Great Again of Donald Trump. He was basically saying, America's pretty darn good. We have the best economy in the world. We have the strongest military in the world. Things here are actually okay, guys.
Oh, I would say he was saying things are more than okay.
Let me start with the economy and a basic fact. The United States of America, right now, has the strongest, most durable economy in the world. We're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. More than 14 million new jobs, the strongest 2 years of job growth since the 1990s, an unemployment rate cut in half. Our auto industry just had its best year ever. That's just part of a manufacturing surge that's created nearly 900,000 new jobs in the past 6 years. And we've done all this while cutting our deficits by almost three quarters.
And he went on to say that the U.S. has the strongest, most durable economy in the world, and that anyone claiming America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction. Wow.
I want to get in on words. This because yes, this was in my mind before you played the sound, right? Your standard State of the Union is that long laundry list of priorities that remain on a president's list. And he knows, given the political reality, composition of Congress, presidential election year, that's not going anywhere. But here's where it was Reagan-esque. It was Reagan-esque in a sense that he's saying, do you want to go back as a nation to where we were before my party and this administration came back into the White House? I think the answer is not. We were coming out of a terrible economy. There was a bad housing market, two long unpopular wars that were costing America troops and treasure. And look at what we've been able to do since. And so that's not just a message for the Republican Party. That's a message for whoever becomes the Democratic nominee, particularly if that nominee is Hillary Clinton, that you can't just skip my 8 years and go back to your president's administration in the 90s, given everything that we've been able to achieve during my administration. But it was also a rebuke of the Republican Party, like, you know, you're peddling sincere fictions. That's a low-key way of calling them liars. So, you know, Joe Wilson said during his first address to Congress, you know, you lie. Well, this is the president going right back at them, well, you're peddling fictions. Translation, you're lying to the American people and you're lying to yourself if you're going to suggest that we are worse off having me in office.
Going back to what he just said, we're in the middle of the longest streak of private sector job creation in history. More than 14 million new jobs, the strongest 2 years of job growth since the 90s, with an unemployment rate cut in half. Keith on Facebook says the president did not acknowledge that the post-2008 recovery is the weakest on record, that the vast majority of new jobs created have been low wage and many of them part-time, or that the drop in unemployment rate is primarily due to the withdrawal of millions of people from the workforce because they lost hope of getting a decent paying job. Who's right?
Well, both. The fact is the drop in the unemployment is not primarily related to that, but it is absolutely related to that. And the truth is there are about six measures of the health of the economy. And if you're a Democrat, you tout the three that says the economy's going gangbusters. And if you're a Republican, you tout the three that show the economy's stagnating and climbing slowly. And the truth is actually in the middle. Yes, there has been a whole lot of job creation, but a lot of those jobs are at lower levels than before. Yes, unemployment is down, but some of that, not primarily, but some of that is actually due to people pulling out.
He also did not mention, probably should have. If I were him, I would have mentioned the fact that maybe the recovery has been slow, but this has not been a normal recovery from a normal recession. This was a recovery from a recession that rivaled the Great Depression.
It was historic in terms of its length, its depth, the variety of industries that were impacted. It was the worst economic calamity of our lifetimes. And in looking at the recovery, it's not as if you had a unified government working across party lines to push job creation. Employment is one of those lagging indicators. It might be the first thing to go down to let you know the economy is going into a rut, but it's going to be the last thing to bounce back. And part of the reason why we've seen a slow recovery is that there hasn't been as much growth in the public sector in employment. State governments are bound to balance budgets, and part of what happened at the state level is that a lot of people were laid off, and those positions haven't come back.
Well, and if you reject federal government spending in terms of a stimulus, if you object to the Federal Reserve Board keeping interest rates low, those are really the only two tools that the federal government has to impact the economy. So in criticizing the president's economic policies and then criticizing the two things that the government has to do it, you're relying on fairy dust as economic policy.
And that's why he mentioned
make things better.
Isn't that why he mentioned the auto industry having its best year ever? The fact that he decided to save the auto industry. A lot of people wanted General Motors to go out of business.
Right, because they, you know, sort of let the market handle. But remember, George W. Bush started the auto bailout. Barack Obama simply expanded and made it larger. And so both can, you know, for the idea, did was a flow over from Bush, who wanted to dump tons of federal money into the auto industry. And Obama simply expanded it and helped it along. But you know, back to Eric's point about fairy dust, you got to remember, you get really deep in the weeds when you talk about what's causing or not causing or not slowing the recovery. Because, you know, once you talk to people who are strong on economics on either side, you're going to all of a sudden, I guarantee you within 12 sentences, you're going to be arguing over quantitative easing, something that the general public still doesn't fully understand and whether or not it actually helped or slowed the recovery. So you get deep in the weeds quickly. I'm actually not surprised he didn't go down that road.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The president stopped just short of delivering Joe Biden's line about GM's alive and Bin Laden's dead. You know, he stopped just short of delivering that line.
Well, he talked about Obama. Osama Bin Laden.
I thought one thing he did effectively from the beginning of the speech. You mentioned he brought up the hope, the yeah, change
right,
theme,
right.
Identified that with progress, both in terms of his administration and historically, and effectively contrasted that with Trump and the Republican candidates, you know, as peddling fear, what we stand for versus fear. You played his sound bites. He dismissed their economic criticism and their foreign policy criticism as hot air and TV sound bites, putting himself in, well, this is the real world versus, you know, their rhetoric. Accusing them of attacking people based on race and religion, again, versus American values, his Sputnik line about, you know, basically saying
we didn't deny that Sputnik was up
in
the air.
We didn't deny it. Instead, we put a man on the moon. You know, so they were all effective ways of putting themselves in the Democratic Party.
So how did that play with the general American public, who his popularity ratings are relatively low at the moment? 64%, I think, of the population thinks the country is headed in the wrong direction. He gets up there for over an hour, a short speech in his term, and lists all the things that have happened in the last 8 years that he has helped turn the country around. They're not buying it. Are they buying it?
Well,
did it play well?
You know, he's and I know this is going to be shocking. He's for curing cancer. And, you know, boy, that was controversial. But absolutely, you know, they're not buying it. It's really not going anywhere except directly to his base at this point.
Well, we'll come back and talk about why they're not buying it. Is it just more of denying the facts, or is there more to it than that? We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members of the Bank of the Ozarks Charlotte Trust and Wealth Management Team, led by Lorraine Eason, who has a commitment to a higher level of personal service. Details at bankozarks.com. And the Charlotte Symphony, presenting singer-songwriter-composer Randy Newman, performing his numerous solo and film compositions, Friday at Belk Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. Well, if you haven't had enough of our conversation, political reporters are going to weigh in on President Obama's last State of the Union speech on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes. They're going to be talking about Obama's final year agenda, including efforts to reform gun laws, which he did not talk about last night, and address voter fears over terrorism and the economy. That's coming up in just a few minutes on The Diane Rehm Show. If you want to join our conversation, there's still time. CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org or through Facebook or Twitter at WFAE. We're coming right back.
This afternoon, let's go somewhere.
We begin the program in Paris, which is...
And then over in East Africa, you have
a series of raids throughout Brussels and other cities.
The first Saudi women to vote, celebrated with hugs and...
The North Carolina Board of Education got some notice yesterday for something it didn't do.
All Things Considered takes you around the world in minutes. Listen every afternoon.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Join me for All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Scott Huffman, Dr. Adolphus Belk, Dr. Heberling. I've been having all these pains, doctors. They're all political scientists from Winthrop University and UNC Charlotte, respectively. The president did get up and he talked about all the things that he says he's done over the years and how the economy is much better than it was when he started, and we have created more new jobs, and the auto industry had the best year ever, the strongest, most durable economy. We'll talk about our situation in the world in a minute here, but he had a glowing report on that. And yet, 64% of the people in the country think it's headed in the wrong direction. Is that because the Democrats and the president, as their leader, have not effectively told this story over the last 8 years, while the Republicans have been beating it over the head, beating a drum of how awful everything is? Or is everything really awful for the average American, and we're and the Democrats are dealing with pixie dust?
I think it's the fact that wages aren't growing. So people feel economic uncertainty.
Which he said is because, not because of immigrants coming into the country and taking jobs, but because of corporate boards deciding they're not going to raise salaries. He put it right in the Republicans' lap last night.
He did. But who's the easier target for most citizens? It's easier to scapegoat people of a different color who you feel are crossing the border rather than
not
your boss.
And not your boss? Why?
Well, because you're...
I mean, I only blame in the history of my employment, I only blamed my bosses for not paying me enough.
and in terms of foreign policy, well, he might have the best available strategy, but when things look like they're going haywire in Syria and the Middle East, again, people are looking for fairy dust, that there's some kind of costless option out there that doesn't involve sacrificing any American troops.
Right, but most military engagements sacrifice troops, a volunteer force in a foreign country. The reason people, I think, are feeling that the policies are failing is that we aren't losing huge numbers of troops anymore. The numbers of troops are, there's still troops dying on foreign soil, but they're fewer. But who is dying? Civilians. So people are actually feeling a direct fear in ways they haven't before, because terrorism is very different than a ground war between two nations.
But he took that on last night. He talked about, yes, we're not fighting in a war between nation states. We're fighting an enemy who is dangerous, but we can't carpet bomb them into oblivion. We have to handle it on a case-by-case basis.
And with that remark, he was speaking directly to Senator Ted Cruz. Senator Ted Cruz is saying that the way that you deal with ISIL is to carpet bomb them, as if there could be targeted carpet bombing when
oxymoron.
Carpet bombing is actually just doing that, like, mass destruction, right? So the president was saying, look, you have all of these ideas. You're saying these things out on a stump, but when it comes down to it, they're not very practical. They're not workable, and it's not a policy solution. You don't have policy solutions for economic growth. You don't have policy solutions for expanding economic and educational opportunity for all. You're failing on the environment, and your ideas for national security are nothing more than bluster. Hmm.
Well, he went to town on the criticisms of his own administration having a weak foreign policy, one in which we lead from behind. These are what the Republicans say. Claims that our enemies are getting stronger while we are getting weaker. And he said, like he did with the economy, all of that is false.
Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth, period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world. No nation attacks us directly or our allies because they know that's the path to ruin. Surveys show our standing around the world is higher than when I was elected to this office, and when it comes to every important international issue, people of the world do not look to Beijing or Moscow to lead. They call us.
Is any of that not true?
The key word there is no nation. No nation would attack the United States. And what you're witnessing now is that you're not fighting a nation state. Mm-hmm. You're fighting a network. With Al-Qaeda, it was a network that spanned 82 nation states. With ISIL, you're talking about an organization that has a reach that's going around 20 to 25 nation states. And so you're not looking at a conventional enemy. You're not looking at conventional warfare. And so if we're going to get down to the letter of the word there with the phrase, no nation. But what you have are people who are willing and capable of issuing targets on American interests domestically, internationally, on American allies. And so that's where I think we can anticipate the president is going to get some hard pushback.
What about what he said? A survey showed that our standing around the world is higher than it was when I was elected to office. That is the direct reflection of his approach to foreign policy as opposed to approach of the previous president. And he did, in the beginnings of his presidency, make this kind of world tour where he tried to say, I'm going to take a different approach. Republicans have said it's the wrong approach. It's a weak approach. Did he make the case last night that he's right?
I don't think he made the case last night per se, but that has been a central element of his foreign policy from the very beginning. And he was quite clear when he ran for president in 2008 that this take-it-or-leave-it approach that was the characteristic of the Bush administration was not the way he was going to approach it. He was going to be more collaborative. He was going to try to build more alliances. He was trying to leverage public opinion in foreign countries in favor of the United States rather than alienating them.
And that did happen. We are, you know, the standing of the U.S. is higher. You can look at the Pew International Studies. You can see this. And yes, it's true that, you know, no nation state is going to attack us, and people do turn to us over Beijing and Moscow. That's true. But it also plays perfectly into the Republicans' hands because the Republicans will say, you miss the point. Our threat is not a nation attacking us. It is this network, as Dr. Buck pointed out, it is this network that you're missing the boat on.
Yes,
so
he's
not going to convince.
But he also said that the Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and some of the other Republicans who are saying this is how we should conduct our tactics against these terrorists simply will not play on the world stage.
In the modern era,
presidents cannot act like this.
Carpet bombing is a war crime now in the post-Vietnam era. So that's absolutely not going to happen.
And this is in line with things that he said before, criticizing the candidates in the Republican field. They talk about the counsel that they're receiving from some of the best military minds in the country. He said, well, if you think you have people that are better than my Joint Chiefs of Staff, and if you think they have better ideas than my military advisors, then by all means, send them my way. Come share. Come talk.
Yeah.
So it's consistent with what he's done.
The president, going back to domestic policy, he claimed that 18 million people are now covered under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and in the process, health care inflation is lower. One of the things that Nikki Haley and other Republicans have said is that health care costs continue to rise, insurance costs continue to rise. But in fact, they were rising every year prior to Obamacare. Is that fair to say that Obamacare has caused this, and is that what they're saying?
As we mentioned earlier, politicians have a way of picking the facts that can both be true, but they pick the facts that illustrate their own point, and that's exactly what you see here. Healthcare inflation is down, but it's still higher than other sectors. So the challenge in talking to voters is that Republicans want to blame the healthcare inflation on Obama, because that benefits them politically.
Have healthcare costs been going up? Yes. Have they gone up at a slower, lower rate than ever before? Yes. So both sides can claim this fact supports me.
And this is something you had to get under control. America spends more money on healthcare than any other in nation state in the world, but we don't have all the superior outcomes in terms of life expectancy, heart disease, diabetes, so on and so forth, infant mortality rate. It was something that you had to get under control. And if you take the really long view, you look at the criticisms that were levied against the Medicare and Medicaid programs when they were first introduced in 57. It took until 65 for those programs to be implemented into law, and they thought that we could insure the old and the poor and then come back for everyone else. We never came back for everyone else. And so this was the first time in a really long time where you had a major policy on a pressing issue that's starting to deliver some dividends.
You know, and one of the things about Obamacare that he was touting last night is important for the new economy was that it's portable, and relying on your employer for your health care is really not as sustainable for a lot of people, because a lot of the growth has been in either low wage employees or contractors. I mean, more and more people are, you know, essentially contractors and not part of the company, so they don't get company benefits.
And he framed that in the new economy speech. He framed that in a way that he said that this ought to be portable like everything else in the economy, meaning our computers are portable. He talked about that, and he talked about the incredible problems that we face today, not because of anything either party has done or not done, but because the world is changing. The way the marketplace works is dramatically changing. Does that resonate with anybody, or are they just worried, I'm not making enough money and I'm working part-time?
It's tough.
And it's your fault.
It's tough because we keep coming back to different facts, right? Verifiable, objective, empirical truths. But Republicans learned a long time ago from people like Lee Atwater that the facts don't matter as much as people's feelings. And if you can tap into what they feel, you can tap into that sense of angst, you can win elections. And that's what people are doing right now. They're tapping into the feelings of the base as a way of building an electable coalition.
The speech, some have said, was not only presidential because he is the president and he's trying to say, here's how you have to act as the president, but it was also somewhat combative. It was almost like he wanted to defend his record and put it out there, but he also wanted to be back on the trail. He's not going to be campaigning ever again.
Well, he's taking on a role as party leader. He doesn't have an agenda that's going to get passed. He only made three concrete policy proposals. None of them are going to pass. This was him taking on his role as party leader to help his party in the next election. He's going to set something up that, assuming Hillary Clinton's going to be the nominee, that she can tap into her base, the Democratic base, and say, here's how Obama has made things better. I'm going to continue that. This was a political speech.
If people buy into what he said last night, I'm not saying they did, but if they did, who would it help more? Would it help Hillary or would it help Bernie Sanders?
I think in some ways, a lot of the arguments would play more with Bernie Sanders when you talk about economic opportunity, educational opportunity, and the type of policies that he's endorsing. One of the things that I've noticed, though, and this goes back to the forum that was held on our campus just some time ago, Hillary Clinton has done a thing where she's sort of reconciling herself with the legacy of her husband's presidential administration, looking at the criminal justice reforms that have expanded mass incarceration and essentially saying we were wrong about some of those things, while also trying to embrace different parts of the Obama legacy, because they can't just act like the last 8 years haven't happened. But at the same time, you want to pull
back. Why would they want to?
Well, because you're trying to turn the page. But at the same time, like if you look at what happened with Al Gore and Bill Clinton, they tried to get away from Bill Clinton because the idea was that his actions had sort of besmirched the presidency and it was time to restore honor. And Bill Clinton was like a caged animal wanting to be on a campaign trail, but they wouldn't have him out there. That was a mistake. They can't make that mistake
when
again.
Bush won, ran for office following Ronald Reagan, was he trying to turn the page from the Reagan years?
Absolutely not, but he was a much more popular president on the way out, and what he was offering was a third Reagan-Bush term. I don't think you're getting that from Clinton. You're not going to get it from Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, but you know, remember, if you take the mean approval rating for Ronald Reagan, it's either literally or virtually identical to the mean approval rating for Bill Clinton over the course of 8 years.
Where I did think Obama spoke to the Sanders crowd was several times. He talked about the system being rigged in favor of the wealthy and corporations, which is not typically language you hear in a State of the Union. Clearly, much more liberal language than even a liberal president like Obama typically speaks. So he's clearly appealing to the left side of the party and saying, look, we hear that, and even though this we can't offer solutions, this is the way that the system is working, and we think something should be done about it.
It was unconventional in many ways. One of the ways was by the things he didn't talk about. He did not acknowledge people in the gallery, and there were people in the gallery. Obviously, the presidents and first ladies now invite people, and there was an empty seat to symbolize the people we've lost to gun violence, something else he didn't talk about. Is that because he just made a really, I think, fairly effective speech in which he shed some tears on gun control in the White House just a week ago?
Well, there's a lot to criticize there. I guess he may feel like, well, we just had the forum. We addressed that just recently. I only have so much time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is the only Nobel Peace Prize winner with a kill list. And if we go back to the 2007-2008 campaign season, he talked about closing Gitmo. He talked about closing Gitmo for almost the entirety of that campaign, and Gitmo is still open for business. So there's a lot
that
can be
criticized.
But he
mentioned he wants to cut it down. They released 100 prisoners yesterday, Yemeni prisoners yesterday. And he said again last night that he wants to close it. And he said it should be closed, and the Congress won't let him close it.
He's putting it on someone else now, but here we are.
Okay.
You know, here we are after all this time.
So, in the final analysis, with less than a minute left, did he convince independents or partisan Democrats who feel the bloom is off the rose that the last 8 years have been worthwhile?
I think he set the basis for Hillary or the Democratic nominee to pull themes and reinforce the themes that he spoke to speak to the angst that moderates might be having and reassure them that the Democrats can address them, that they don't have to go to the angry reaction of Trump and some of the other Republicans.
And you get the last word. Dr. Eric Heberle, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Adolphus Belk, professor of political science and director of African American Studies at Winthrop University, and Dr. Scott Huffman, political scientist and founder and director of the Behavioral Research Lab and the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks